Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Kia ora tātou katoa, and welcome to the Museum of New Zealand Te Papa Tongarewa Wellington, and to the second of the 2010 Treaty Debate Series in Soundings Theatre. My name is Claudia Orange, Director of Collections and Research at Te Papa, and I'm chairing the session tonight with Dean Knight, Senior Lecturer in Victoria University's Law School. The series is actually organised by Te Papa and Victoria University's New Zealand Centre for Public Law, and we very much appreciate that association. It's actually been organised, this series, as a way of providing you, the public, with information and on treaty-related issues, and also to give you an opportunity to consider and to discuss those issues. It's actually the sixth year in the series, in the various areas that we have dealt with. Each year we focused on what we thought were issues that had been pertinent and relevant as they appeared in the public press and over the various dinner tables. Amongst them, of course, we've had the foreshore and seabed issue, fisheries and Māori rights, another year the Māori seats in Parliament, and also, of course, I think on probably one or two occasions, the progress and key issues that have been made in the whole settlement process. This year, the title for the series is Evolution and Not Revolution. We wanted to take a wider view of where we are on treaty matters, and that is exactly what we're about to do. I'd like to welcome Professor Mason Jury, who is the key speaker for this session. Subject for his lecture is the Treaty of Waitangi, Domestic Relations, Global Impacts, and a New Zealand Agenda. And at the conclusion, Colin James will offer comment, and then, of course, we'll ask for questions and comments from you. But first, let me introduce Professor Jury. Mason is of Ngāti Kaufota, Ngāti Raukawa, and Rangitāni. He is Professor of Māori Research and Development at Massey University in Palmerston North. As a psychiatrist, Professor Jury has focused much of his research on Māori health, but his interests range over all the issues facing Māori in the 20th and 21st centuries, including constitutional change. He's widely published on health and Māori issues, one of his most recent books in 2005 being Ngā Tai Matatū, Tides of Endurance. Professor Jury received an honour in the new year, and he is a companion of the Order of New Zealand. Professor Jury.
O tira ngā reo, ngā kārangatanga maha, koutou hoki o te kāinga, tēnā koutou. Tēnā koutou ko tai mai i tēnei pō, kei te mihi hoki ki te papatonga rewa, ngā koutou te reo pōheri, te reo karanga, ko tai mai tātou, ki te ato tirotiro tēnei take, ko te treaty o Waitangi. O tira kei te mihi hoki ki a rātou ko wehi atu, I tēnei pō ki te maumahara ki tērā tumuaki o te papa ko Seren, nāno I wehi atu I a tātou I tērā tau. O tērā kei te mihi hoki ki a tātou katoa kua taimai I roto I ngā tūmanako o tēnei tau hau. So thank you for the introduction, Claudia, and it's wonderful to have an audience who applauds before you even start, and so warmly and with such heartfelt sincerity. but I'm really grateful to be asked to participate in this year's series of seminars. I think that the origin of the debate and the purpose behind it is something that's really important to this country, and to have the opportunity to be part of it is important. I'm really conscious that the views I'm going to talk about tonight are just a small sample of the total range of views that are available and that people have on the treaty, and all I'm doing, I think, is making a small contribution to our understandings of the nature of this country, and the role that the treaty has played in the past, the role that it plays now, and the role that it will come to play in the years ahead. Well, you know that this year marks the 170th anniversary of the Treaty of Waitangi. It was signed in 1840 by William Hobson, who represented the British Crown, and by over 500 chiefs who represented most, but not all, tribes. The treaty was an international agreement, and it was intended to accelerate the forward development of New Zealand as a modern state. At that time, competition between France and Great Britain for the control of the South Pacific was an important ingredient of the international dimension that comes to be part of the treaty. And securing a base in the South Pacific and being ahead of competitors was one of Britain's strategic reasons for coming to New Zealand and expanding the British Empire. Although in recent years the treaty's importance has been stressed, the significance of internal arrangements have been emphasised, and there has been a strong historic focus. But over the next few decades, and this is probably the main point I want to make, international relationships rather than domestic relationships, and future developments rather than a focus on the past, will shift the debate around the treaty away from a purely internal orientation and a recital of historic injustices to a global arena and an agenda for tomorrow. The treaty's application to the future can be expected to overtake its significance to the past. A recent treaty settlement highlights exactly that point. In June 2008, the Crown and eight tribes from Central North Island, the so-called Central North Island Iwi Collective, CNI, the eight tribes agreed, and the Crown agreed on terms for settling long-standing grievances relating to unfair land alienations. Made up of 176,000 hectares of Crown land, accumulated rentals valued at around $250 million, 3 million New Zealand units of carbon credits, and a preferential right to purchase certain Crown properties, the CNI settlement is by far the largest in New Zealand's history. The Central North Island settlement is also the most comprehensive, insofar as it embraces the interests of eight neighbouring tribes and will lead to the establishment of a forestry company, a geothermal energy company, and a carbon farming company. Moreover, the settlement is premised on a 100-year developmental time frame. Not until the year 2109 will the collective's right to first refusal of government properties expire. So on a continuum between the resolution of past injustices on the one hand and securing a sound economic platform for future generations on the other, the Central North Island Agreement appears to be much more strongly aligned to the future than to past grievances. In that respect, a new era of treaty relevance could be emerging. Though the past two decades have largely located the treaty dialogue within a historic context concerned with righting past wrongs, in the case of the CNI settlement at least, but actually well beyond that, a Treaty of Waitangi relationship between Māori and the Crown has the potential to shape the future of the nation on a scale that has not been previously contemplated. But a future focus around the treaty should not be too surprising. When the treaty was first signed, it carried with it the expectation that New Zealand's forward development would see a transition from a tribal society to a modern nation ready to stand alongside the wider community of nations. Britain would gain new territory, bringing both strategic advantages as well as new wealth, while the tribes would benefit from any economic, social, and civic gains without disadvantage or loss of standing. The treaty was essentially about facilitating a new future for Aotearoa and for its people. In the event, less than 20 years after signing the treaty, those expectations were being questioned by Māori and disputed by the settlers. In 1856, the tribes had participated in a hui at Pukaua on the shores of Lake Taupō to share their fears about the erosion of tribal estates and their lack of voice in decision-making. The Pukaua discussions led to two major conclusions. The first conclusion, kotahitanga, unity between the tribes, was necessary in a new environment. And second, kingitanga, the anointment of a Māori king, would be an effective way of gaining unity. Although neither conclusion was implemented in quite the way the tribal participants had envisaged, there was nonetheless a very strong sense of urgency to address new times with new structures that would bring fresh opportunities and a greater say in the nation's development. Meanwhile, the outbreak of hostilities between Crown and Taranaki tribes at Waitara in 1860 highlighted both settler impatience for forward development and Māori dissatisfaction with a process that did not seem to bring the promised tribal benefits. Concerned about the possibility of future hostilities, 150 years ago this year, Governor Gore Brown convened a four-week conference at Kohimarama in Auckland. Apart from the iwi of Taranaki, who were otherwise engaged with surveyors and soldiers, and Waikato iwi, who were mourning the loss of the first Māori king, Potatau te Whero, the 1860 Kohimarama Conference was attended by representatives of almost all the tribes. But in contrast to the Pukaua hui, where the focus was on a Māori response to colonising efforts, the Kohimarama Conference was about the relationship between Māori and the Crown. Claudia Orange's groundbreaking research suggests that Governor Brown wanted to impress upon the tribes their obligation to be loyal to the Crown, as stated in the English version of Article 1. But it seems that the Māori participants were much more interested in the Māori version of Article 2, with a guarantee of tino rangatiratanga. Possibly because the links between the two articles were not really explored, Kohimarama had ended on a high note, though as it happened, each party was high for different reasons. The governor had concluded that a pledge for loyalty had been obtained, while iwi were now much more aware of the extent and the potential of Article 2. But regardless of the goodwill generated at the month-long deliberations, the covenant written at Kohimarama was not able to provide a mutually agreed way forward. Iwi assumptions about tino rangatiratanga remained at odds with imperial notions of sovereignty, and tribal opposition to settler incursions was interpreted by the Crown as Māori disloyalty. Inevitably, relationships between Māori and the Crown deteriorated. Land wars extended beyond Taranaki, and calls to abide by the spirit of the Treaty of Waitangi were effectively offset in 1877 when the treaty was declared a simple nullity without any binding legal consequences. Disillusioned with the relationship, iwi now pursued other options for exercising authority, including the setting up of a Māori parliament, Paremata Māori, in 1892. 50 years after the treaty had been signed at Waitangi, and despite the introduction of Māori electorates in 1867, the relationship between Māori and the Crown had failed to reach a sufficient level of accord that could bring certainty to both parties. The treaty and the notion of partnership within the treaty had been effectively sidelined. Well, although Māori retained faith in the promises made at Waitangi for a better future, it was not until 1975 that there was any discernible public awareness of the implications of the treaty to modern times. Simmering unrest about dwindling land holdings, marginalisation of Māori urban dwellers, and the strong possibility that the Māori language could become extinct spilled over into more strident protest that culminated with a historic Māori land march led by Dame Fina Cooper. The extent of unrest caught many New Zealanders by surprise. Most had been blissfully unaware of Māori discontent and the smouldering sense of injustice. Government, on the other hand, had not been entirely oblivious to Māori concerns, and in the same year as the land march, the Treaty of Waitangi Act 1975 established the Waitangi Tribunal as a commission of inquiry to investigate claims against the Crown for breaches of the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi. As it happened, claims were relatively few over the next decade, but in 1985, an amendment to the Act extended the jurisdiction of the tribunal from 1975 back to 1840. That was the signal for large numbers of claims, small and large, and covering lands, fisheries and forests, to follow. To speed up the settlement of claims, the process of direct negotiation was introduced. Where there was agreement as to the facts, whether those facts had been determined by the tribunal or not, claimants and the Crown were now able to negotiate the terms of settlement and to reach an outcome that would be both fair and durable. Well, notwithstanding the emphasis in the so-called fiscal envelope policy on compromise and affordability, rather than full compensation based on principles of justice, the major claims have now been settled, and many claimants are well placed to establish sustainable economies that will allow greater self-sufficiency. Māori economic investments are higher than they have ever been and continue to grow at an unprecedented rate. I'm aware I said this was going to be about the future, and you may be wondering what events occurring 150 years ago at Kohimarama or 25 years ago when the Treaty of Waitangi Amendment Act was passed, you may be wondering how they are related to New Zealand's future. It's true, both have historic significance and cannot be entirely separated from the times in which they took place. But both events are also about the evolution of relationships between Māori and the Crown. Mistrust, misunderstandings and misjudgment have all too often been part of the relationship, and they have left indelible scars. But if the Central North Island Agreement is any guide, there are also increasing signs that Māori and the Crown are refocusing their mutual interests towards the future rather than the past, and in that respect are returning to the broad point of the treaty, which was about the emergence of New Zealand as a modern state within the worldwide community of nations. The indications are that the post-settlement era, which now contextualises many tribal plans, will see a shift away from grievance and adversarial bargaining between Māori and the Crown towards a relationship based on a futures agenda, the prospect of mutual benefits and greater national prosperity. In turn, however, the post-settlement era will likely raise other questions for the tribes, including whether the relationship between Māori and the Crown will be the most relevant relationship for Māori in the decades ahead. New Zealand in the year 2035, 25 years from now, will predictably be subject to quite different pressures from those experienced in 1840 or even those operating today. First, New Zealand's future will be significantly shaped by a changing demography. By 2035, Māori will make up a greater percentage of the total population, close to 20%. Apart from an ageing of the total population, the other significant demographic transition will be an increase in New Zealand's ethnic diversity. Maori, English, Scottish, Welsh, Irish and Dutch backgrounds will be complemented by a larger number of Chinese, Indian, Korean, Malay, Philippine, Samoan, Tongan, Fijian, Rarotonga and Kiribati settlers, as well as comings and goings from Australia. This diversity will not only add to the country's skill mix, but it will bring new understandings to our society about democracy, commerce, and sovereignty. Importantly, New Zealand's colonial attachment to Europe and the Northern Hemisphere will give way to a Southern Hemisphere identity and greater pride in being part of the Asian Pacific region. New Zealand's future, however, will also reflect other worldwide trends. The recent economic recession, for example, has shown how events in the United States can seriously pressure New Zealand industries, force higher levels of unemployment, and freeze real estate. Of even greater concern will be the effects of global warming and climate change. Already there is clear evidence that without nationwide agreements to reduce carbon emissions and revegetate denuded landscapes, the planet and humanity will be seriously compromised. The age of oil will come to an end and other forms of energy will need to be harnessed. Natural resources, such as fresh water, will become scarce commodities and their ownership will be a source of tension between iwi, farmers, commercial interests, local authorities and government, all vying for control. Living in a global community will have a double edge to it. Global colonisation, a process already in train, brings with it entry to worldwide markets, international educational prospects, access to unprecedented volumes of knowledge and information, and exposure to the world's music, art, and literature. The opportunities for Māori and for all New Zealanders at home and abroad will be unlimited. But they will also demand compromise. Increased globalisation may mean that Te Ao Māori, the Māori world, becomes submerged by other customs, and in the process, a distinctive way of life will be transformed into a bland adaptation of a global norm. There is the risk that tikanga, kawa, te reo Māori and those other markers that characterise Māori in modern times will be lost to whatever global fashion holds dominance in the world at any particular time. But no matter how unpalatable that prospect, it would be short-sighted of us to assume that New Zealand is sufficiently isolated from the rest of the world to have immunity from global transitions. Indeed, even when the Treaty of Waitangi was signed in 1840, global competitiveness between the powerful colonising nations of the world and overpopulation in industrialised cities in Europe were reasons for Britain's interest in New Zealand. Although forecasting the future is difficult, given the rate of change, the advent of new technologies and the consequences of new epidemics and other calamities, there are trends that can provide useful signposts about the directions we can expect to see. Demographic patterns, for example, as well as emerging political alliances and global climate change, have impacts that can be, to a large extent, anticipated. Nonetheless, futures planning is an imperfect art and an additional way of considering the potential impacts of national and international events on Māori and on the treaty is through the construction of scenarios. Scenario development is a method of exploring the future and it takes into account already known trends, previous patterns of development such as 19th century colonisation and horizon scanning to detect, for example, the emergence of new technologies. To illustrate futures planning, and some of the possibilities that New Zealand may face by the year 2035, I have constructed three very different scenarios. The first scenario is about New Zealand's constitutional future. It assumes that by 2035, New Zealand will have declared itself a republic with a new head of state. That possibility had been canvassed at a national conference in the year 2000, but no firm conclusions had been reached and the debate was shelved. But in the wake of developments in the European Union during the 2020s and the consequent impositions placed on royalty in Scandinavia as well as Great Britain, constitutional monarchies had fallen out of favour. In addition, the large number of New Zealanders of Asian descent had little or no interest in perpetuating a constitutional framework that emanated from the Northern Hemisphere. In the event, transitioning towards a republic had been surprisingly uneventful, except for three questions. First, should the president of the new republic be appointed or elected? Second, should we have a written constitution or simply a continuation of the nation's reliance on a series of conventions supported by pragmatic innovation? And third, with a final exodus from a colonial past, what would be the status of the Treaty of Waitangi? Of the three questions, the third proved to be the least problematic. Despite a rearguard protest that the treaty was an instrument of division and should be ignored, most Kiwis, including Pacific and Asian communities, thought that the rights of Indigenous peoples should be maintained, and because the treaty allowed for negotiated solutions rather than dogmatic assertions, the treaty seemed to be the least difficult way of doing that. Moreover, in the wake of highly successful Maori enterprises in a post-settlement environment, the Treasury, no less, had long since concluded that New Zealand's distinctiveness was a function of a vibrant Maori economy and an indigenous approach to climate change. According to the Treasury, retaining the treaty not only recognised Indigenous interests, but also affirmed the brand necessary for New Zealand to be competitive in a global economy. Then, once agreement had been reached that the benefits of a written constitution far outweighed the dangers of having no constitution at all, the Treaty of Waitangi was integrated into the constitution as an overriding statement about New Zealand's Indigenous peoples and the nation's Indigenous resources. For the first time, the treaty now had explicit recognition as an entrenched constitutional element, rather than existing solely as part of a fuzzy national conscience. By 2035, the Republic of New Zealand was widely recognised as a champion for social cohesion and for indigeneity. It may not happen. In contrast to the first scenario, in the second scenario, by 2035, New Zealand had become integrated into the Confederation of the States of Australasia. Again, to relieve your anxieties, this may not happen either. Two factors had contributed to the formation of the Confederation. First, concerns about global warming and the high expenditure of carbon credits on long-distance flying meant that Northern Hemisphere markets, including tourism, were less attractive to Southern Hemisphere countries. Second, strong Asian economies were competing with both Australia and New Zealand and effectively playing one off against the other. Well, largely in response to the new economic circumstances, which had been evident as early as 2015, New Zealand, Australia, and some small Pacific nations agreed to explore the possibility of a new set of alliances with a single currency, a single passport, and a single government. New Zealand was generally enthusiastic about the proposition, but a stumbling block had been the New Zealand Crown's commitments to the Treaty of Waitangi. Australia was reluctant to see any reference to Indigenous peoples incorporated into the new arrangements. And they were reluctant because they feared it would unsettle the now settled Aboriginal population. Despite having eventually agreed to the 2006 Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Australian states had effectively bought out Aboriginal domains through a system of compensatory payments that expired in 2020. In their view, all obligations to Indigenous peoples had been met, and adding the Treaty of Waitangi to the new Confederation's agenda could introduce an argument that the Australian government did not wish to revisit. New Zealand eventually complied with the majority view and reluctantly accepted that the treaty status would be confined to cultural matters and would not impose obligations on the new federal government. By 2035, the state of New Zealand had taken its place as one of 10 states making up the Confederation of Australasia, and in the process, the treaty had been effectively consigned to history. Well, unlike the second scenario, Scenario 3 expects that Māori will be leaders in worldwide Indigenous networks. One network, Global Indigenous Systems, was established in 2025, largely as an initiative of the Indigenous Peoples Forum at the United Nations. The global recession, which started in 2008 and continued through to 2011, possibly, had unfortunate, longer-lasting repercussions for Indigenous peoples in many countries. Further, although many nations had signed up to the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples in 2006, few had actually encouraged Indigenous economic development. The Global Indigenous Systems goal was to advance Indigenous economies through worldwide Indigenous collaboration. Meanwhile, by 2020, it had become clear in New Zealand that Māori investments following treaty settlements had led to new wealth, greater experience in economic development, and expertise in financial management and governance. The impact of the economic recession had not been as severe as it had for other Indigenous populations, and Māori were keen to maximise economic returns and build economies of scale. As a result, Māori Integrated Economies was established in 2022. It represented an amalgamation of Sea Lords, Tree Lords, the collective CE&I companies, Māori Providers Limited, and the Ahu Whenua Trust, a consortium of Māori land and corporations. Māori Integrated Economies had provided a model for integrating economic and social capital by bringing together a mix of resources and had become a major player in the New Zealand economy and a world leader in Indigenous economic development. When Global Indigenous Systems was established by Indigenous peoples in 2025, Māori and Integrated Economies was invited to provide overall leadership and to extend their model across global Indigenous networks. By 2035, Māori had become masters in integrated solutions, and Māori Integrated Economies was the dominant economic force in New Zealand. The New Zealand government, aware of Māori wealth and aware of Māori commercial partnerships with international businesses, saw the treaty as a really important vehicle for the state to lever off Māori enterprise and gain entry into global markets. The Crown now seemed to place greater emphasis on the treaty than the tribes. Well, the three scenarios are all possible, though not all of them would be equally popular or equally probable. Scenario two, that was about the one about the Confederation of the Australasian States, would probably have the least appeal to New Zealanders. Scenario one, that was about the Republic of New Zealand, and scenario three, which was about Māori integrated economies, would certainly be more attractive to the tribes and to Māori and possibly to all New Zealanders. But my intention for sharing these scenarios was really not to enter into a debate with you about which of the three would be more probable or which of the three would be more desirable. I simply wanted to illustrate how the position of Māori in Aotearoa and the standing of the Treaty of Waitangi in the future cannot be contemplated without considering the global context and the inevitability of significant economic and political change in the future. Importantly, it cannot be assumed that current Māori perceptions of constitutional rights will necessarily apply in the future. Take, for example, the Treaty of Waitangi. While the treaty has been both an enabling and disabling instrument, it may also inadvertently have narrowed Māori horizons. The Treaty of Waitangi was essentially an understanding about the relationship between Māori and the Crown. Under the treaty, sovereignty, or at least the right to govern, was exchanged for guarantees about property and citizenship. The treaty gave some protections, but also positioned Māori alongside the Crown. In a sense, Māori had been captured by the state at the expense of other potentially more profitable relationships. There are no good reasons why the treaty should be the single most important defining statement about the position of Māori, or for that matter, why Māori should not enter into other treaties. Debates about the relationship between Māori and the Crown, which have occupied great legal and academic minds, both Māori and Pākehā, have tended to measure Māori political legitimacy against the criterion of sovereignty, a concept that is culturally bound and increasingly bound by time. Not only will sovereignty and the notions of sovereignty be subject to the permeation of global philosophies and global quests for power and wealth, as evidenced by multinational companies, but the sovereign boundaries between states will become blurred as digital technologies shrink distance and the mix between public and private interests become increasingly intertwined. For those reasons, it would be unwise for Māori to measure tūnuranga tiratanga solely against the parameters of the Crown's sovereignty, whatever meaning sovereignty might have in the future. The Copenhagen Conference and the addition of folic acid to bread, both widely debated in 2009, are signs that New Zealand's sovereignty will come to reflect overseas pressures and trends as much as Kiwi aspirations for self-determined dominion. In addition, in a post-settlement environment, it is likely that Māori engagement with the Crown will alter in both purpose and intensity. That does not mean there will be no relationship, but a two-directional change in the nature of the relationship can be expected. First, Māori involvement with the Crown will be increasingly focused on New Zealand's agenda for the future rather than on compensation for the past. Recent discussions between the Crown and the Iwi Leadership Forum in relationship to water management provide an example of a new type of relationship, while the Central North Island settlement is clearly aligned to the century ahead rather than to the century past. Second, Māori will predictably choose to spend more time and energy exploring relationships with the private sector, seeking investment opportunities with overseas companies, and playing leadership roles in global indigenous networks, and spending less time engaging with the Crown. To meet those changes, it may be opportune for Māori to enter into a new set of treaties with other parties beyond the Crown and beyond New Zealand, and geared to the 21st rather than the 19th century. A treaty partnership with the Crown will remain important, but the nature of the relationship will increasingly reflect mutually beneficial interests in the future, and in addition, there will be greater Māori interest in other types of partnerships, both here and abroad. Well, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention tonight. We are, of course, tonight really grateful to Te Papa Tongarewa and Victoria University and Radio New Zealand for arranging this, and we're especially grateful to Dr. Claudia Orange, whose work in continuing these has been hugely important to their success. I mentioned earlier that there are many perspectives on the significance of the treaty, but the central point I've tried to make tonight is that the relationship between Māori and the Crown will always be an evolving one, shaped by domestic realities and priorities, as well as by global events and international alliances. Essentially, the treaty relationship hinges on goodwill and the recognition of distinctions between sovereignty and tino rangatiratanga. Over time, however, both sovereignty and tino rangatiratanga will take on new meanings. As the globe shrinks and New Zealand's future as a Pacific state in the wider Asia-Pacific region consolidates, our sovereignty and independence will increasingly reflect the priorities and the economies of our neighbours. And in parallel, our understandings of tino rangatiratanga will also change. Measuring it against the single yardstick of sovereignty may in fact already be outdated. The standing of Māori and Aotearoa will not be defined solely or even mainly by notions of legal sovereignty or rights conferred through the application of the Treaty of Waitangi. Increasingly, tino rangatiratanga will be a product of demographic significance, economic might, and international recognition. Ironically, that position may not be too far removed from the situation in 1840, when Britain became conscious of the natural wealth of New Zealand, aware of iwi, tribes, as indigenous proprietors, and were hopeful that Māori might become strategic partners in a competitive world. Indeed, they were the very reasons for signing the treaty. Kia ora.
Thank you, Professor Jerry, speaking in the second session of the Treaty Debate Series at Te Papa in Wellington. And I'll now ask Colin James to comment, but first to introduce him. Colin is an associate of the Institute of Policy Studies at Victoria University. A political journalist for more than 30 years, he's the author of 6 books, writes weekly columns in the Dominion Post and other Fairfax newspapers and the Otago Daily Times, and a monthly column in Management magazine. He also has a website. He analyses and forecasts the policy environment in which businesses and other organisations must operate. He runs a forecasting service, the Hugo Group, which has 100 medium and large corporate members at chief executive level. A very busy person, I think. So, Colin, over to you.
Kia ora tātou, and thank you, Claudia, for the invitation in this challenging, these challenging times. Well, Claudia has now twice cast me as a riro to a tōtara in this annual Te Papa Waitangi series. 3 years ago, I followed Sir Edward Jury. This evening I follow Sir Mason Jury. And these brother totaras are of great stature. They root deep into the earth. A riro riro is a momentary flutter. So first I will set some context, which I've written and spoken about at length over the years, and I'll note them only briefly now. First, Aotearoa is Pacific. This is a fact of geography and has gradually been becoming a fact of life as Māori words, custom, culture and protocol seep into the mainstream and as links with Polynesia reform. This is the Pacification of New Zealand. We are now increasingly of the Pacific, not just in the Pacific. Second, New Zealand is economically and to a large extent socially a segment of Australasia. For 40 years we have been re-Australasianising, integrating our societies, economies and policies, and to some extent our politics. Economic or geopolitical forces might drive this tiny nation to federate as a state. Australians, I think, would resist Sir Mason's scenario 2 confederation. But equally, the forces of climate change, mass migration, geopolitics and geoeconomics might drive us in other directions. Third, New Zealand is an outlier society. First, an outlier of Polynesia, from which it separated 600 to 800 years ago. Then an outlier of Britain, from which over the past 40 years it has been separating in mentality and custom, though not in heritage. And now increasingly an outlier of Asia, as migrants and investors make themselves at home and some set up and buy enterprises here. We are Asianizing and may in time become a sort of vassal state of China, whence will come increasingly ideas that drive science and technology and social and economic organisation. Next, I note, again only in brief, three forces that I think shape the evolving treaty. First, the treaty is both reality and fiction, both of which have been important in aiding this nation to firm and to find meaning. I examined this at length here 3 years ago. Second, the focus in Māori issues has, since at least 2003, been shifting from rights to development. Education, training and skills, managing and developing iwi assets, and fostering entrepreneurial enterprise. Rights remain important, of course, but more in their exercise than in their recovery. There is a limit to anger as an engine of progress. A loose parallel is with the 1980s, when younger women bothered less about claiming rights than exercising rights their mothers had won. Third, over the past 40 years, the ex-British and other later arrivals have been indigenising. There is no other home or land for those born here with now up to 7 generations of forebears in this place. Their culture and customs are now distinctively New Zealand Aotearoa. In 2035, it will scarcely be credible to assign exclusive Indigenous status to someone who is 128th Māori by accident of birth or casual liaison. It'll be obvious from what I've said that I agree profoundly with Sir Mason that as we enter the post-settlement era, there will be a shift from grievance and adversarial bargaining towards a relationship based on a future's agenda. I agree too that it was expected in 1840 the treaty would see a transition from tribal society to a modern nation, and that tribes would benefit from economic, social and civic gains. It is time to recover that 1840 objective of progress. I also agree that there is no good reason why the treaty should be the single most important defining statement about the position of Māori. And given the real commercial weight some iwi have been acquiring, still little known, I might say, outside iwi, we have cause cautiously to share Sir Mason's optimism that Tinoranga Tirotanga will increasingly be a product of demographic significance, economic might, and acknowledgement by peers. His Scenario 3, International Leadership by Māori in Worldwide Indigenous Networks, and his vision of international alliances, both not dependent on the treaty, are intriguing. But it will also be obvious from what I said earlier that I disagree with Sir Mason's statement that the treaty is about the relationship between Māori and the Crown. First, the Crown is a fiction. Bagehot distinguished 140 years ago between the dignified, the ceremonial and powerless monarchy, and the efficient, the powerful cabinet and bureaucracy. In this fictional treaty parlance, Georgina Tahirhiu, Peter Sharples, Tariana Turia and Paula Bennett are both Māori and the Crown. And when Sir Mason's Scenario 1 Republic arrives, which may be beyond his 25-year time frame, it will become obvious just how fictional the Crown has been. Second, the treaty was between sovereign iwi and hapū and the sovereign state of Britain. It applies to iwi and hapū issues, spheres of influence, assets and taonga. there was and can be no treaty relationship between Māori in general and the Crown, except under Article 3's conferment of subject status. But that is a relationship every citizen, which is the modern word for subject, has with the government. Māori and other citizens are born, live and die under general laws. Māori pay taxes on their incomes in the same measure as other citizens. If they're out of work, they receive the same work and income benefits. They drive on roads according to laws made for all in cars made in some other country. Their children go to schools paid for by the government and expected to meet government-set standards. They are operated on in the same hospitals. That is Article 3. And if they are in some way disadvantaged, the treaty is not the remedial agent. The modern concept of citizenship connotes full participation in society and the economy, which implies state-guaranteed action to reduce inequalities of opportunity. Moreover, the modern concept of that action includes ensuring assistance works, and that implies sensitivity to cultural and other differences, which in turn includes understanding and working with different world views. That is the genesis of and mandate for Tare Nauturia's Whānau Ora project and Māori entities delivering education, health and social services. That is not Article 2 matter dealing with iwi and hapū autonomy. It is Article 3 dealing with citizenship. Well, being citizens does not require Māori to be post-enlightenment individuals stripped of whakapapa, custom, tikanga and heritage, though many Māori do choose to be post-enlightenment individuals here and abroad. This is a Pacific nation and society, and the outlier Polynesian culture has its place here as much as the outlier ex-British culture. But iwi culture and custom will change. As we normalise te reo, words will acquire new meanings and connotations. As we mainstream tikanga, it will adapt. Modern Māori arts, crafts, dance and music are bending and stretching tradition. Iwi governance is modernising. That will not make a half-brown homogeneity, but neither will there be pre-1840 dark brown and fair white, except in special places and on ceremonial occasions. In this evolving society, the treaty will evolve. It will have its place as a fact of history and as a fact of recovery of lost rights. It will be a moral and probably legal guide for the limited purposes of Article 2, perhaps codified by Sir Mason's Scenario 1 Republic. But the mystique some have attributed to the treaty, the claim some make for its superior constitutional status, and the convenient fictions which have influenced governments will lose their edge. The treaty, too, will normalise. That evolution highlights an observation by a 40-something friend last week, that before you this evening are two ageing men. These past 40 years or so, the treaty has been Sir Mason's and my treaty in different ways. Over the next 40 years, the treaty will be the treaty of the under-35s. When they are ageing men and women on platforms such as this, what, if anything, will they have to say about the future of the treaty?
Well, thank you very much, Colin. You're listening to the second session in the Treaty Debate Series in Soundings Theatre Te Papa on the subject of the treaty with speakers Professor Mason Jury and Colin James. Now, as you know, it's an opportunity for you people to think and discuss and consider how these issues might impact and how they relate to New Zealanders. And so we're now going to invite questions and brief comments from the floor. And I'll hand over to Dean Knight at this stage to lead those off.
Kia ora mou tena. In this session, we've turned our attention to the future. We have been provoked by three very different scenarios from tomorrow that I think challenge us to think differently about sovereignty, nationhood, and tino rangatiratanga. So it's now time for you, the audience, to participate in that debate by posing questions to our speakers. You will see there are microphones at the front of the auditorium on either side. If you would like to ask a question, please make your way up to one of the microphones and queue up as necessary. A reminder, when you speak, please give your name and briefly your involvement with treaty matters, if any. The microphone is sensitive, so please speak directly into it. but not too close. And please remember to make your comments brief and to frame your contribution by way of a question. With that, we now invite questions from the audience.
It would be exceptional if we didn't have somebody. And while you are thinking about it, perhaps I should ask Mason if he has any thoughts on what Colin has said, or if you wish to make any comment yourself on those.
I would hate to take the time away from people who want to ask questions.
BA student, Victoria. I wonder if Mr. Drury could comment on how national standards in reading and so forth and the apparent lack of a plan to respond to them if they produce unwanted results will contribute to scenario three. Thank you.
When I worked as a psychiatrist and I was asked a question, the standard reply is, well, what do you think? But a couple of things. The scenario three suggests that Māori will have a pretty high level of capability in economic terms, in social terms, and in cultural terms. And underpinning that has got to be success in education. If there is going to be a radical change in the notion of whānau ora, for example, it really has to hinge pretty closely on success in education. We don't enjoy that at present for a number of reasons, and there are many, and they've been well rehearsed, though not well addressed, but have been well rehearsed in recent times. The reality, I think, for many young Māori, particularly, I'm told, men, boys, is that they leave school with minimal levels of literacy and numeracy. And if any program can address that and increase that so that the outcomes in education are good outcomes, I think we should applaud that. But whatever is happening now is not doing it sufficient. We have some brilliant pockets. Some pockets of absolute brilliance where Māori groups with schools or clusters within schools are doing exceptionally well and well above a national average. But that is not the universal picture. And we need really to focus on really improving educational outcomes in a way that will make Scenario 3 possible.
The if I may add a little bit... The issue is not what children are taught. The issue is what they learn. And there is some work which is really still at the pilot stage and ought to be expanded, in my view, in South Auckland and Hamilton and elsewhere, to shift, to get teachers to rejudge themselves or assess how they are going, not how their kids are going, by what the children are learning. Too many teachers over the years have had an assumption that brown kids can't learn. And if you go back to that first 20 years that Sir Mason talked about, it's no doubt at all that Māori can learn, and learn very fast, and learn too fast for the British settlers' comfort. So that's the challenge. I don't think that the standards issue per se will do much about that, but the techniques are there, they're being applied. And if they were applied much more widely at some expense and with a lot of effort, then over time I think those statistics would change.
Thanks, Colin. I see another question over there.
Yes, thank you. Brian Smythe, relocated to Wellington after 46 years as a general legal practitioner in Nelson, and I won't mention the weather. I had some association with treaty claims through the Te Tau Ihu claims that were heard in Nelson a few years ago, and I've had some association with the health system and seen how that works from a Maori perspective as well as a non-Maori perspective. I have a simple question. It may be a cliche, but I'd like to hear comment from both speakers about whether we are to be regarded, in fact, as a multicultural or a bicultural society, and how that really ought to impact on treaty matters in the future.
You go first.
It's not a question of either or. We are both bicultural and multicultural. We are bicultural, as I said before, because we are an outlier society of Polynesia and we're an outlier society of Britain. And that makes us bicultural, but we're also multicultural. The two are not in conflict that I can see. I think perhaps you have some discomfort with the notion of the equality of status accorded to Māori language and English language. Well, it doesn't actually have an ordinary everyday use equality of status. It does in officialdom. I think over time, my third outlier argument is from Asia. If you look out 100 years, I think we'll be much more Asian. We're already more Asian than China. I used to say, I've been arguing this for 20 years, so I'll go on arguing it. I used to say we'd better get a better treaty.
Mason, I'm sure you'll want to comment on this.
I agree that we are already a multicultural society, have been since 1840. The Scots, the Welsh, the Irish, they all came and brought their own. You go to Dunedin, you could well be in Edinburgh. We have been multicultural for a long time. The question, and that'll increase. The question really is, how is this country going to value, if it values it at all, how is it going to value indigeneity? By indigeneity, I mean indigenous peoples characterised by that their language is a first language only in this country. That they have a particular association over time, hundreds of years. And the question that comes up really is not whether we should devalue other cultures who come here. I don't think we should. I think we should do our best to support the cultural aspirations. But the underlying question is, how does a country intend to value indigenous people and indigenous resources? And the treaty, I think, has something to say about that. But we've often discussed the treaty without discussing the underlying issue. And the underlying issue is about the question of where do Indigenous people stand in the values of this nation.
Thank you, gentlemen.
I wonder if I might be permitted one question from the Chair, and really to link it back to the earlier debate in this series where the Speaker spoke of a reasonably successful evolution in the Māori Pākehā Māori Crown relationship, perhaps under the banner of a minority rights model where Māori are more empowered to sort of react against the imperial oppressor. But I think what we're being challenged with today is to reframe that in terms of a new mission of an outward-looking relationship. But I wonder whether, well, what might be the catalyst is for that change in the battle cry? I mean, does that require a revolution from within Māoridom as well? And how successful might that be over the next 25 years?
I don't think it's a revolution. I think there's been an emerging pattern, and it's evident now, perhaps more than it has been in the last two decades, but over the last five or so years, there has been a distinctive change in Māori aspirations and Māori ambitions. And it's away from, I think as Colin was saying earlier, it's away from a focus on rights to much more a developmental focus. That's already emerging, and I don't think it requires a revolution, although they might say that on Saturday. But there is a trend that's already evident.
Yeah, I'd agree.
Eileen Brown, I work for the Council of Trade Unions. My question is about whānau ora, but also about the labour market. Today, the unemployment figures came out, and the unemployment figures for Māori were, I think, about 15.4%. So you both talked about, Mason and Colin both talked about whānau ora and how that will address some issues. And you talked about innovation and you know, there's good innovation happening and great possibilities. But when we look today at those figures of unemployment and that huge disparity, what is necessary to do today in order to perhaps reach that positive 2035 scenario that Mason Dewey talked about?
Mm-hmm. Actually, I think I talked about three, one of which was positive. But I think the short answer to your question is education. If we're talking about unemployment, we cannot unbundle that from successful education, and that's why the first question we had tonight, I think, is so important, because education is really the critical determinant of a decent job, a good income, and a healthy life. So I think it really is what we can do today is to make sure that no child, Māori or Pākehā, leaves school without having the benefits of good education and having achieved a high educational standard. Second point about whānau ora, you may have to wait a little while because the report isn't out yet. I'll give you a preview, just a little one, and that is that whānau ora really recognises that families don't live in silos. They don't live in an education sector and then a health sector and then a justice sector. Their lives really are a bit of all of those. And our approach to Māori development, particularly at a family level, has very often been a fragmented one where there hasn't been a sense of integration and holistic development. On top of that, we're pretty good at crisis intervention in this country, but we often leave the family when the crisis is solved rather than when the family is empowered. And I think what whānau ora is really about is converting a crisis to an opportunity. Take an example. If a child's truant from school, there's a crisis. The aim is to get the child back to school, and then the crisis is over. It's actually not over. The crisis is over when the child is back at school, very, really important for the reason I mentioned earlier, and when the child's family values education and is enthusiastic about education, and when the school that that child goes to values Māori kids and is not prepared to let them fail. That's when the crisis is over, and that's what whānau ora is about. It's using a crisis as a point of entry to empower a family. But the full story will be out within a week or two.
Just add a couple of things. I think that iwi do have a role to play in this as they become richer and more skilled, and they use the professional middle class, which is developing, I think, quite fast. But that's only part of the issue. I think this is intergenerational. This probably takes probably takes a couple of generations to turn around, and it requires, we're getting a little bit off the treaty point here, it requires a shift in the mentality of those delivering the services or those paying for them from regarding it as a cost to seeing it as an investment. And if you make that shift, you don't, for instance, close down Te Huringa because that's a good investment, even though it's expensive. You get good results. If you apply taking the whānau ora project, you intervene or you find a way through the door at age zero, actually age minus 9 months, so Peter Gluckman insists, and you continue that sort of approach. It's expensive, but those kids will come out at 15 far more likely to be literate and numerate and rich. And I think the treaty was about getting rich.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're running against time now, and I think I really need to bring this evening to an end. And that, of course, is the end of the 2010 Treaty Debate series from Soundings Theatre at the Museum of New Zealand Te Papa. The treaty has taken it as its theme this year, evolution and not revolution, and the subject today, domestic relations, global impacts, and a New Zealand agenda. We didn't quite solve completely what that agenda might be, but certainly it has stimulated a lot of discussion. Speakers were Professor Mason Jury and Colin James, with help from you, the audience, and from us, Claudia Orange and Dean Knight. And thank you very much indeed for coming.